guys, continue enjoying your pizza. It looks delicious. Tonight, the topic that I was handed to discuss. Anyone know? Are you here for the topic or are you here for the speaker? This is like the test. What's the topic? Co-ed relationships, right? Co-education, co-ed relationships in general. Education is more when you're younger. This is more relationship-related issues. So many, many years ago, I wrote an article for the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society before the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society closed down and then reopened. So it was a long, long time ago. About co-education, about educating children in institutions that have boys and girls in the same classes, on the same buses, sending kids to co-ed camps and things of that nature from a halachic perspective, not from a hashkafic perspective, but purely from a halachic perspective. At the time, I was teaching in DRS, which is an all-boys high school that is affiliated with the Hebrew Academy of Long Beach, which is a boys and girls, but not mixed together in the same classes, boys and girls elementary school. And I remember I was walking to the Beis Medrash, and in DRS, the old boys high school that I was teaching, and one of the board members of HALB saw me walk in, and he said, I saw your article, you can print your retraction anytime. I said, no, I think I'm good. I'm okay. I'm not going to retract anything that I said. And someone else came over to me and said, it was probably very unwise of you to, true or not, whether what you wrote is true or not, and it's all true because it's just sources. I didn't say anything of my own, just collected all the sources on the topic. He said, whether it's true or not, it was very unwise, because it could be, you think of yourself right now as a Rebbe in DRS, where, you're safe in your own little Dalet Amos, and you have this little shul in North Woodmere where you're safe and no one's going to bother you. But it could be that at some point a modern Orthodox institution is going to want to hire you, and this is going to apostle you because you said that it's less than ideal for boys and girls to be brought up in the social atmosphere together, and no modern Orthodox institution is going to hire you. So here we are at the flagship modern Orthodox institution, and it seems to have worked out. Maybe they didn't know about this article. I didn't say anything so crazy. The idea is that men-women relationships, from a purely halachic perspective, from a perspective of what the Torah says, are fraught with danger and many potential isurim. And most of the positives that come from friendly, I don't mean cordial, I mean friendly, warm, close relationships, men and women, most of the positives that can emerge from that are not necessarily Torah values and Torah ideals. They're other values and other ideals, which also may have some meaning to them and some value, but certainly when weighed against the Torah dangers and the halachic dangers, it's not even close. I also think, just over the years, now I did look back at the article that I wrote, I actually printed it out, I have it here with me, I did look back, and there were certain parts of it that, were immature, meaning that I was young, I was very young when I wrote this article, and I would quote random educators in co-ed institutions who wrote things online to justify or to explain why it's really a good thing, just to use it as a straw man to argue with, and that was immature, right? There's no reason to bring in names of people, without just making the argument straight. So, I was somewhat immature. I'm very grateful as I'm looking back at it. There are certain sentences in this article that I'm looking at, and I'm thinking, thank God my father-in-law edited this article for me, because he fixed so much of the language and really toned it down and added nuance that I was unable to see in my youthful kanaos. We tend to be, when we're younger, we tend to see the world in black and white. I don't just mean the way that we dress, although sometimes that's part of it also. Whereas one of my sons told me that a Rebbe in the yeshiva where he's currently studying says, yeah, the boys in that chair are black and white. White shirts and black lungs. So we tend to see the world in black and white when we're younger, and we come to appreciate a little more nuance as we get older. So I'm very grateful that it could have been a lot, lot worse. But let's maybe just talk from a pure Torah perspective, from a pure halacha perspective, And then we can maybe open the floor for questions and, you know, discuss, you know, if there's anything that's on your mind about these types of issues. You know, not whether every co-ed school has to immediately shut its doors. You know, that's silly. You know, let's not be so black and white, but whether on a list of, if you were painting a picture of the ideal Torah institution or the ideal Torah lifestyle, how much interaction would there be between the genders? And I'm not just talking about in school, I'm talking about after school, when you're married. And, you know, I remember when I got married, my brother gave me a chassan shmooze. What's a chassan shmooze? So now every chassan, when you take chassan classes, you get the basic hilchos nida, and then the chassan teacher will also sit you down and give you like a shmooze, you know, about Shalom Bayis and about Eitzah and Hilchos Tznius also, and you know, things of that nature. So when I got married, that was not always done, and even the way chassan classes were done were totally different. The way we did chassan classes is Rabbi Neuberger gave a class, and by a class I mean like in a classroom like this with 20 people, and you were just sitting in a class and taking notes, and it was Hilchos Nida, and that's all it was. So my brother, seeing that I was never getting real you know, direct hadracha, wanted to give me a chassan shmooze. And I remember one of the things that he said to me at the time was, you know how, like, you're not supposed to talk to girls when you're in high school? You're really not supposed to talk to an ishus ish, you know, unnecessarily. Meaning, like, the people think, oh, once I'm married, I'm safe, and I could socialize as much as I want with people of the opposite gender. The issue does not go away. If anything, since most of the women you're going to be interacting with are going to be an ishus ish, you have to be even more careful to make sure that those interactions are appropriate. Since it's going to be appropriate that you're going to be in a co-ed atmosphere, because when couples are sitting around the table at a wedding or at a Shabbos table or something like that, there's nothing inappropriate about that, and that is totally fine. But you have to be more on guard to make sure that the relationships don't get too comfortable. I remember when my brother got married, and then a year later my sister got married, so they both lived in Baltimore. At the time, my brother was learning in the Kol Hillel Ner Yisrael. My brother-in-law was working in a financial firm called Legg Mason in Baltimore, and they were both living in Baltimore at the time. And I remember spending Shabbos there, and I noticed that many of their friends, when they would refer to my sister-in-law or my sister, they would say, you know, thank you very much for the meal, Mrs. Leibowitz, everything was delicious, or thank you very much, Mrs. Eisenberg. And I was like, wait, but you're the same age, like, you know, she's not like 70, like, why are you calling her Mrs. Leibowitz or Mrs. Eisenberg? You know, why don't you just call her name, Faya, Yael? You know, like, I could tell you their first names, like, I know them, you know. So and I didn't realize that that's a sensitivity within that community, that the sensitivity within that community is that in order to create a certain barrier, in order to create a certain sense of distance, they don't call women by the first name. They only men by the first name. They refer to the opposite gender, and it works to create a certain amount of distance. I remember Rav Schachter told us once that he had to call up a certain Talmud of his to ask him a question, and the Talmud's wife answered the phone, and he said, "Oh, hello, Mrs. So and So. I hope you're doing well. You know, how are you? Is your husband around?" And the woman said, "Rabbi Schachter, you know me for 30 years. You don't have to call me Mrs. So-and-so. Call me, what, did you forget my name? You can call me by my name." So Rabbi Schachter said at the time, Itaka did forget her name, but that's not the reason I call him. Is like, I thought it's appropriate that there should be some, you know, some distance. It's interesting that when I spoke to Rav Asher Weiss about this, I don't remember the context that it came up, but I did ask Rav Asher Weiss whether he thought that should be done, and he said, "Nah, it's silly. You know someone for decades, and you know them by their name. So now you can call them Mrs. So and So." He said, "I don't think that really makes sense. I don't think that's something you have to be machmir about. Different sensitivities for different people. Probably you would have predicted that the YU Rosh Yeshiva would have come down on the other side of that question, and the, you know, the Kleisenberger Chassid would come down on the other side of that question. Probably you would have predicted, unless you ever met Rav Asher Weiss or Rav Schachter. But nevertheless, you know, in fact, I once said that, and someone sent me an email saying that it's, I don't believe you. I don't believe Rav Asher Weiss would ever say such a thing, and until you send me a recording of him saying it, I'm not going to trust him. I'm like, okay, fine. No one told you have to trust me. You know, that's okay. You cannot believe anything I say. That's okay. So there, but there is that sensitivity to not to, you know, to sort of have that barrier. I think as a community, our community, and by our community I mean, you know, we are here in the Modern Orthodox flagship, you know, in the Modern Orthodox community. One of the issues when you describe, when you have a conversation with a Ben Torah from a different yeshiva, you know, someone who is a true Ben Torah who's learning in a typical yeshiva. You know, we are not a typical yeshiva. I mean, just the very fact that we're different than the rest of the world tells you that we're not exactly a typical yeshiva. You know, better, worse, otherwise, just different. We're just, you know, we have our own, you know, way of doing things and way of thinking about things. When you talk to a Ben Torah from a typical yeshiva, and they go on the attack, they say, can I be honest with you? Can I ask you some honest questions? And they start, you know, asking about all of the problems that they perceive with modern orthodoxy. They're not asking about colored shirts, because no one in their right mind thinks that that's actually a problem to wear colored shirts, right? They're not asking about, you know, well, how could you learn science? You know, no one cares that you're learning science, right? There's no one that thinks that that's going to turn you into an apikoros anymore. That was the battle of like 100 years ago. No one's worried that that's going to turn you into an apikoros anymore. Typically, what they're challenging you on and what they're asking you about is the perceived tremendous lack of tznius in our community. And it's a very hard charge to defend. And to say, oh no, we're all good with tznius. Meaning, they'll say, no, but like, I've been to your communities. Like, I see what goes on there. I walk into the pizza shop on the Motzei Shabbos or whatever. Like, I've seen, you know, like, I've seen how people walk down the street. I've seen how boys and girls interact. Why does every boy in Modern Orthodox High School have a girlfriend? Why? I've seen this. This isn't something that, you know, this is real. And it's very hard to you know, why do couples go on vacations together and they're going to the beach and they're going to Cancun and they're going to Puerto Rico? I actually have a very close friend who told me that he and his family are going on vacation, you know, to one of these places. I don't remember where, Cancun, Puerto Rico, or something. And his son, who's just coming back from yeshiva now, is joining them for a vacation. And he said, I was so confused. He said, I said to my son, yeah, I know that I'm not supposed to be going there, but you're coming out of yeshiva. What's wrong with you? How do you go to you go to a place like this? That was so funny, you know, that like the son said, I'm just trying to be part of the family. That's what they're telling me in yeshiva, not to rock the boat, to just go along with what the family's doing. So but the father's like disappointed in the kid, like, you know, you should be on fire now, you know, you shouldn't be this is like the stage in life that you're supposed to be in. But it shouldn't just be a stage in life. I mean, we do have some fixing to do in terms of the levels of tznius. Now, where am I pulling this from? This idea that that we don't believe in complete comfort level between the genders and all of that. So there are a few halachic sources that are very, very clear, but none that is more clear than what the Shulchan Aruch himself says in Ibn Ezer, Simin Chav Aleph, where the Shulchan Aruch uses unusually strong language to describe the distance of the relationship between a man and a woman, and how ma'od ma'od a person has to be marchik mina isha, that a person has to be very careful to create a proper sense of harchaka between man and woman. The Aruch HaShulchan in Siman Tavkuf Pei Gimel Siv Dalid says that in a community where women attend Tashlich on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, the men should not attend Tashlich on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. Meaning, stay away from situations that are going to create an overly social environment. And we should try to limit the interactions as much as possible, not to mention the issues of Shmiras He'enayim. That's what the Aruch HaShulchan writes. Rav Shechter, when we were writing the Batei Yosef, have you seen like the beta version of the Batei Yosef? So the Sefer of the Hanhagos and Psakim of Arashi Yeshiva, so I had the opportunity with a small group of Rabbanim to sit with Rav Shechter and get his Piskei Halacha on things. And one of the things that I wanted them to include, but they didn't, about Tashlich, is that we asked Rav Shechter, you know, when he does Tashlich, do you do it on the first day of Rosh Hashanah? Where do you go? Are you makbid that it be, you know, a place with water and fish and whatever? So he said, no, I don't go to Tashlich. When I give my shiur in Brooklyn on Monday night during Aseres Yemei Tshuva, and I'm driving over the bridge, if I remember, I'll say, as we're driving over the bridge, and that's his Tashlich. You know, there are like 20 pages of small letters in your master of Tashlich, so that's Rav Shechter's Tashlich. So he said, Rebbe, why don't you go to Tashlich? So he said, because I remember when I was a teenager, when I was 15 years old, Rav Nissen Alper told me that I shouldn't go to Tashlich. So I don't go to Tashlich. why did Nissen Alper tell a 15-year-old kid not to go to Tashluch? Probably because he was concerned that there would be a social scene there and that it would be a Gira Yetzer Hara. Probably 80-year-old Rav Shechter is not going to be in significant danger of socializing with all the women at Tashluch. But nevertheless, he said, Rav Nissen Alper told me I shouldn't go to Tashluch. So I don't go to Tashluch. But the Shulchan Aruch is very clear in the strength of the language that he used. There's a similar language that's used in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, where the Mishnah says in the fourth parak of Pirkei Avos, Ma'od ma'od havishfal ruach, that a person should be exceedingly humble. And we know about the midah of humility in general with most midahs. The Rambam says we're supposed to try to find like a happy medium where we're not too much of this or too much of that, and that we're somewhat balanced. The person shouldn't be, it doesn't mean not too frum or too, or too mezalzel mitzvah, somewhere in the middle where you're only a little bit mezalzel mitzvah. So it's not what a happy medium means. Happy medium means that a person is not too anxious all the time or too relaxed all the time, meaning that your midos, the way that you, your personality traits are balanced. If a person is too anxious all the time, they should probably, work on that, whether with a therapist or otherwise, to work on that so that they're not always feeling so anxious. If a person is so laid back that nothing bothers them, so that's also a problem. There should be some things that, that you get concerned about, that you, so most midos you're supposed to find, the Rambam says, that middle ground. When it comes to gaiva, you're really supposed to be marchik as far as you can from gaiva. You have to have a little teeny tiny bit of gaiva, shmina, some tiny measure of gaiva, but gaiva not in the sense of arrogance, in the sense of pride. That you have to at least take pride in who you are, take pride in what you do. That's the gaiva that you're supposed to have. But ma'od ma'od havishval ruach. So that same expression is used by the Shulchan Aruch. So that's probably what the Shulchan Aruch is referring to. We're not moderate. We're extremely cautious when it comes to these. Now, obviously, it should be it doesn't need to be stated that this does not mean that if a woman is walking down the street that you have to run to the other side of the street. It does not mean that if you see someone you've known for your entire life, they say, I don't talk to you. You're always kind. You're always nice. You're always concerned. You always go out of your way to help people, man or woman. It just means that there should be a certain sense of distance in the way that we do things. And it means when we're choosing schools for our children, it does not mean that if they're boys and girls on the same campus, that it's automatically that school is out. But it means that among the criteria that we're looking for is an overall sense of tzinius. And it should be one of the things that we look for, just like we look for a sense of midos tovos, and we look for a sense of Yerushamayim, and we look for a quality education, and we look for relationships with rebbeim and teachers, and we look for social, the ability for a child to acclimate socially, and the ability for a child to develop self-confidence. On the list is the level of tzniyus in that school. That is certainly something that should be on the list when we look at these things. Now, when you're already in college and you're already thinking about shiduchim, or you're already in shiduchim, so obviously, or maybe it's not so obvious. It's not obvious in every community, but I think for people brought up in the modern world and with great exposure to the modern world, it is very, very important for us to feel a certain comfort level with the woman that we're going to marry, and to develop that relationship. You may think, that's so obvious to me. It's not always obvious. A dear friend of mine was telling me that he was talking to his nephew, who recently got married, comes from a very different kind of background, a much more yeshivish kind of background, and his nephew's moving to whatever city, I'm not going to mention, and he said to his nephew, you're moving to that city, what made you choose that? He said, my kala very much wants to live there. He said, once we get to know each other a little bit more, then maybe we'll discuss it again, and we'll see if we'll move somewhere else. And my friend was just like so taken aback by that. You're marrying this woman. Once we get to know each other a little bit more, I would think you would know each other before you get married. But that's the world that we come from, where that is the expectation, that we know each other very well. Can a marriage work where a couple is committed to get to know each other? They just know that they basically work nicely together, but they don't really know each other well, and then they get to know each other through marriage? Guess what? Every marriage works that way to a degree, and of course a marriage could work that way. But for the most part, people in our community need to have in order to be You know, to not have like a panic attack the week of your wedding. We need to have that sense of being comfortable and of feeling that we have a good relationship, and that we have a deep knowledge of the other person. So therefore, you know, we do have to reassess how boys and girls meet when it's the right time. You know, there is this misconception that the problem is that if kids aren't exposed to a co-ed environment when they're in high school, then a guy is never going to know how to talk to a girl. So that's, I think there's actual research that's been done on this, and what they find is either that's not true or the opposite is true. Meaning, if you talk to your wife the way you've spoken to your high school friends who were girls, you are doing a bad job. That is not the way you're supposed to talk to your wife. I mean, the way you're supposed to talk to your wife is that you should adore her, you should respect her, you should... The way high school guys, for better or for worse, it's usually for worse, the way they flirt with girls is they make fun of girls. And they say things, you know, joking around, whatever, and, you know, and they say things that are crude or inappropriate, or they're in a crowd and they'll make some comment that will be funny and everyone's there, they can get a good laugh out of it. If you do that with your wife, that is a problem. That is not the way. So very often we learn bad habits by the way that we interact, because we're interacting when we're very immature. If you're interacting when you're... There's another thing. I remember when I was engaged, we went to my brother and sister, both living in Baltimore, so we went there for Shabbos, and my brother pulled me aside after Shabbos, and he said, the way you talk to her, that's got to change. Because I happen to have known my wife since high school. So the way I learned to talk to her was as a 16-year-old, because that's when I met her. And my brother's like, I'm like, no, you're a small guy, doesn't know anything about girls. But it turns out that he was right, right? Meaning that you have to talk in a more mature way, in a more respectful way, and that's something that needs to be worked on. I do think that the shidduch system is, you know, there are lots and lots of flaws. It's obvious that there are lots of flaws in the way that guys and girls meet. Moreno Rav Shechter Shlita, years ago, decades ago, was trying to encourage us to develop programs where guys and girls can meet in a more natural environment, where they don't have to be all these checklists that, you know, you have to check off in order to be able to, you know, get to a first date or get past the first date, where, you know, like just meet naturally and you'll get past whatever issues that there are if you've actually fallen in love with each other. It would be a wonderful thing if we can do that. It's not easy to accomplish. Shachtu at the time suggested maybe at all the weddings the chassan's friends and the kallah's friends should sit together at the same table, and some people actually did that, and it failed miserably. Like, everyone was just awkward and uncomfortable about it, and it wasn't, you know, they suggested do co-ed events in yeshiva or something like that, you know, like where Rebbe says a shir, and there's boys and girls that attend the shir, but any boy who would attend such a shir, then, you know, like it's all so like everything is like and then Rav Shechter stopped saying that the boys and girls should sit at the same table at weddings, because he saw that the way girls dress at weddings, he says the dress has got too tight, it's impossible to have Shmiras Ha'inayim, and he stopped encouraging that. So it is difficult. I always thought like the ideal would be like a Camp Hask, except the boys are 3 years older than they actually are in Camp Hask, you know, that would be ideal. I mean, you know, we got a good one, Charlie, you know, but you know, it would have been great to get you 3 years later. We got you, but you know, that, I always thought that would be like the ideal, meaning when they're actually ready to meet and you're able to interact in, what does Ravino call Camp Hask? Kodesh Kadashim? Or is that just something that when he came to Kaylee, he told us, yeah, Camp Kaylee is Kodesh, but Hask is Kodesh Kadashim. You know, that was what he told us. So, you know, but to have that kind of environment, ideally, that would be great if we could make it happen, and if people weren't so resistant to those kinds of things when it's relevant. When it's not relevant, it's probably really not a great idea. But then after you're married, also when I'll tell you, I get together with my friends from high school, mamish, some of them from before high school. We get together several times a year just to hang out. You know, we'll have a Shabbaton, we'll all get together for a Shabbos somewhere. We'll, you know, wives, children, whatever. Usually for Shabbos we won't invite the children, but you know, we'll Thanksgiving Day football game, you know, turkey, the whole business. you know, not watching a football game, actually playing football, you know, and you know, whatever, you know, and it's great. And what I and what I find often happens, most often happens, is that you know, obviously we all know each other very well, and we all talk to each other. But most often, as the conversation develops, the guys hang out with the guys, and the girls hang out with the girls, and because the topics that they're interested in talking, the topics the women are interested in talking about, are topics that you know, will make a guy want to blow his brains out. If I hear another word about a shaytel, you know, I'm gonna. But and the topics that the guys want to talk about, you know, obviously we're talking and learning the whole time. What's so funny? The topics that we want to talk about, probably the women aren't so interested in, and that's the way it should naturally develop. But I think in a healthy environment. Now, I wasn't sure where we should go with this. I haven't said any Torah yet. So should we? Yeah. So I think you see different streams of Judaism take it in different ways. But one thing is clear, is that it should not be the same kind of relationship that you have with men. Meaning it has to be something where there is a certain distance that is created.
It's far stronger than that, right? What's the honest, really honest, like, you know, answer to that question?
Yeah, I mean, look, the Mishnah says in Kiddushin, that when you teach your child a profession at the very end of Maseches Kiddushin, you should avoid teaching a profession that's bein hanashim, that's among the women. I think this is also something in our community, in the Haredi community, in every community, where women work, and very often they don't think about what the workplace is going to be like in terms of tznius. You know, there have been many situations I've been aware of where. There are just barriers that were broken down just because you're working late into the night with people. So, you know, that's why, is that so many from girls, you know, from women want to become occupational therapists, physical therapists? Because you could just sort of do your thing, you know. You don't have to be in a situation where you're constantly surrounded by men and working together with men. It's not so healthy. It's something that we have to be cautious. It's a reality that we have to deal with, but it's not so healthy. It's not something that. So, is an honest assessment of Ma'od probably should be? We should try hard to avoid putting ourselves in that. Meaning to be proactive, not just to be reactive to it. Oh no, it's late at night, I have a project I have to get done. Looks like me and my immediate superior are going to be in the office alone till 2 a.m. and she's a good-looking woman or bad-looking, whatever, she's a woman and we're going to be in the office alone till 2 a.m. Oh no, what do I do now? Maybe think about, like, what kind of office environment am I going to be in? What kind of... Well, nowadays no one's in any offices anyway, so you could just stay on Zoom. But... you know, but that's something that we should think about. Maybe that's what Ma'od means.
So you mentioned how in high school kids are naturally going to be talking to each other in a certain way and interacting with one another in a mature way. Do you think instead of, let's say, whether it's separating, we should just be teaching the mature way at a much younger age?
So I think that there's always teaching mature way in the right context. What's the right context? You have a family over for Shabbos at your Shabbos table, so you should know how to say good Shabbos. How are you? You know, a very cordial conversation in the presence of adults. It is impossible to avoid serious averos when you have young men and women unsupervised or only supervised by each other. In regular social context. I mean, if your experience is otherwise, I don't know if I'm glad to hear it, troubled to hear it, or whatever, but, you know, I'm shocked to hear it if your experience is otherwise. I think it is nearly impossible, if not impossible, you know, mayasa haben velo yechta, to put a young boy or girl in a situation where they're socializing with other young men and women with limited or no supervision, and you know, and or even with super shmir say nayim, all of these things, like, these are real things. Kedusha is a real thing in Yiddishkeit. So it's true, we grew up, many of us grew up a certain way, so it's hard to hear, and and it doesn't mean that there's something wrong with my school and therefore I resent them because my school is co-ed or the camp that I... We should have great hakaras hatov to the schools that we went to and the camps that we went to that taught us a love for Yiddishkeit and that brought us to a point where we want more and we want to continue. You have to realize these schools were founded and these camps were founded when the other option was no Jewish school for the boys or for the girls or no camp environment that has a Jewish nature to it at all. And obviously communities should reassess and communities should strive for more. Rav Lichtenstein once said when he was asked, Rav Lichtenstein Zichron Lebracha was asked about this topic, and he said a school has responsibility to reassess, not every day, because that would be stupid. If you reassess every single day, you'll have no solid foundation, but every once in a while to reassess what should we be doing different about everything. What should we be doing differently about education? What should we be doing differently to enhance the Avas HaTorah? What should we be doing differently to enhance the Midos? And what should we be doing differently to enhance the chances of a greater sense of Kedusha? When I went to MTA, for example, I went to MTA for high school. So when I went to MTA, there was no such thing as DRS when I went to high school. So I went to MTA. So when I went to MTA, the majority of my class was going to co-ed camps and came from co-ed elementary schools. Now, I saw Rabbi Shanker this past summer visiting, and Rabbi Khan visiting kids in Camp Kaylee, and I said, oh, you guys going to like Morasha, Masora? They're like, yeah, it doesn't even, I mean, we go to Morasha Kolel, but it doesn't even pay for us to go to Morasha because we have like four kids in Morasha. There's like nobody in Morasha. Everyone's on NCSY Kolel, Camp Sports, and Camp Kaylee, and meaning the school. And I said, how did that happen? So he said, well, Rabbi Khan tells the Rebbeim that they should discourage the kids from going to a covered environment. And if a parent sends a kid to a covered camp, Rabbi Khan will make it very clear to them that that is not our hashkafa, meaning you're sending your kid to an all-boys school, so the assumption is that he should be in an all-boys environment in the summer also. That was a drastic change. I'm not that old, that's a drastic change from the way things were 30 years ago, right? Where did that change come from? It comes from a school that's honestly assessing, are we ready for this? When Rabbi Kamenetsky started DRS, he asked Rabbi Willig, what should I do? Anything that I need to, any rules I need to put in place? And Rabbi Willig said, no co-ed camps. He said, well, then I will not have a school. And Rabbi Willig said, okay, so yes, co-ed camps. But at a certain point, probably, he's going to have to reassess that also. Meaning, we're always looking to, and every healthy institution should always be looking at how we can improve. But I think sometimes when people your age, and I was your age once also, and that's certainly the way I viewed the world, was that the assumption is that if you're not fixing everything now, then you're Rishayim, and then you're a bunch of Prutzim. That's not how the world works. Things happen, they happen incrementally when they're happening in a healthy way. They happen incrementally, but we should at least know what our values are.
Curious what Rabbi thinks about guys who are in yeshiva now that will go to like co-ed camps or like be counselors on NCSY more so to have like be mashpia.
So that's a fair point. Meaning you're going to be mashpia on kids, and you've been to those camps. You know where these kids are coming from. You have, at the same time, you're not holding by shiduchim, and you're going to be working very closely with the female counselors. And the campers themselves are not little girls. They're guys and girls who are 16, 17 years old. And they're not dressing in a tzenua fashion, so that's something you should really speak to your rebbeim about to see whether it's worth the trade-off. It's not always worth it. The assumption that it's always worth the trade-off, because I could be mashpia. A lot of times we overvalue our contribution that we can make. What do they call it? War wins above replacement, right? Like, we assume that, yeah, this camp could be okay without me, but it's going to be great with me. Without me, none of the kids are going to be frum. With me, I'm going to be learning Mishnayos with them all the time, and I'm going to be... That may or may not be true. It's sometimes healthy to have a conversation with someone else who's a little less biased to be able to... to assess whether that's the right thing or not the right thing for you. I'm not saying it's the wrong thing. Sometimes it is the right thing for you. But to really assess it honestly.
How do we understand Al Tavra, Sicha, and Mahisha in regards to one's wife?
Yes, that's difficult. So sicha, I think the assumption means. So some of the Rishonim explain im ishto nida, im ishto when she's in nida, that and sicha means like more flirtatious kind of speaking. So don't do that even with ishto nida, because that's the halacha is in Shulchan Aruch and some kuf tzadihei that. That you're not supposed to lo yischok v'lo yakal roshima. The Shulchan Aruch says in Simun Kuf Tzadihei, and the Ramah adds afilu b'dvarim, that even with words you shouldn't have schok v'kalas rosh. That doesn't mean that you're not allowed to be nice to your wife, and that you're not allowed to be funny or tell a knock knock joke to your wife. Those usually aren't funny anyway. But you know, but it means that you shouldn't be flirtatious with your wife. If you understand that it's not referring to ishto nida, then probably it just means to have conversations that that are not befitting of a bento. Types of conversations where we'll leave it at that.
So according to the Mepharshim that say that sicha means flirtatious conversation, what does the Mishnah mean when it says al tarba sicha imaisha?
Because you are supposed to flirt with your wife a little bit, but not when you're.
Beishas
chaveru amur kal v'chomer. Beishas beishto amur kal v'chomer. Beishas chaveru.
Right. But so what we're saying is that.
Right.
Is
so
that
you should avoid it entirely with beishas chaveru. Right.
Right. It doesn't say that. It says al tarba.
No, because beishto amur.
Okay. So
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead.
You talk a lot about the halachic issues with the kohen. I'm very curious what you think. What are the possible, whether it's halachic, whether it's societal, benefits to having a kohen environment?
What are the benefits? So there are parents that will not be comfortable in sending their kid to a Jewish school that doesn't have a kohen environment. I think they feel that it's antiquated and it's whatever. And if you can give a kid a Jewish education to the point where you could ignite their neshama and they're going to want to learn Torah and live an observant lifestyle, and otherwise they would have ended up, you know, in a school of a different denomination, let's say. So it is important for the Orthodox community to service, people like that. So that's certainly a benefit. Meaning, is it possible that in certain circumstances you'll have a broader understanding of people's emotional needs, of different people's strengths and weaknesses? It's possible. That is possible also, depending on what else you've been exposed to. Meaning, like in your home life, if you have sisters or you don't have sisters, like if you, in my house, for example, we have four sons, our first four are boys, and then the fifth one, our fifth child is a daughter. I always tell people, the Gemara says, you're not supposed to be Mishana ben bein abanim, you're not supposed to treat any child differently than the others. But if you have four boys and then you have a girl, you could favor the girl. It's okay. So if in the Hakdam, it's my sefer, I said, I'm so blessed to have four sons, Yoni, Yisrael, Zacharia, Daniel, and Biti Ayikara v'Nachmada v'Ahuva. we don't hide it. I remember when my daughter was born, we asked my sons, now there's going to be a girl in the house, what should we buy her? So like they said, we should buy her pink Yankees hat. like they couldn't think outside of that, that context. They couldn't, sometimes you have no exposure whatsoever. So I guess that would be something positive. I'm not sure what else is really positive. They find in educational settings that it's usually it's harmful. There was a study that was done. I have a very close friend by the name of Joel Mayle. He lives in Lawrence, and he has a brother who's a Gevaldige Talmid Chacham, who's an industrial psychologist by the name of Fishel Mayle or Fred Mayle, and Fishel, Rabbi Fishel Mayle wrote a beautiful sefer with a lot of Kabbalah and Chassidus and Halacha and everything about the Shvatim. Very, very fascinating stuff. So anyway, he's an industrial psychologist. He got a grant from the Bush administration years and years ago to study the effects of coeducation. And what they found is that it was very, very unhealthy for the girls. In a classroom with the boys, the girls felt intimidated. They didn't share as much. They didn't. They were afraid to say something that would come off as sounding silly or stupid or whatever. And they couldn't. They weren't opening up as much. That it's not. It's actually not healthy. I mean, the age old argument that psychologists say coeducation is healthier. Usually, when you have like things like that, the Torah Kedosha got it right. Usually, and in this case, is no exception.
Can I follow up on that? I don't want to.
Yeah, sure. We still have time. Yeah.
Couldn't you make the argument that it's up to the educator or the teacher to provide the environment in which for both men and females to feel safe and encouraged to share?
Yeah, but I mean, you could try to do that, but when you're fighting an uphill battle, because there's nature that you're fighting against. I mean, there is this this male dominance that females are, you know, that the girls are worried about, and there's this aggression, and boys act out more. They found also, certainly in the younger grades, not in high school, but in like fourth, fifth, sixth grade, the boys have to show how macho they are, so they act out more, and they're more chutzpahdik, and they're more. So yeah, of course, a teacher should have repercussions for acting out, and that's whatever, some sort of system. I remember when Rabbi Emerson Shlita was the discipline czar in DRS. There was a system, you know, like his yisod was. I assume this is still his yisod, that the teacher is never punishing you. The system is punishing you. You know what the system is in advance, and if you shout out, oh, just it says there in the booklet that you signed at the beginning of the year that means that you get 2 points off or whatever. So I love you. I want to do it, but it's just the system that's doing it. So you have a system, and you have something that where it doesn't become personal. That's great. You should do that. But why would you create a situation where you have to overcome more? It's hard enough to educate children to. Build more battles into it. I don't see why it's necessary.
I'm curious what you think about female teachers for male students or rebellion for girls.
Yeah, so this is a sensitivity issue, you know, female teachers for male students and the like. It is important, I think, that if you're running a yeshiva, that there are certain yeshivas that are very makbid about this. There are girls' schools that are makbid that the school my daughter goes to, the principal told me that they only hire frum teachers. They don't hire non-religious teachers. In DRS, we often hire non-religious. They often hire non-religious teachers, non-Jewish teachers. You know, and it hasn't proven to be a major problem. But if a teacher is going to be a role model, whatever. So different levels of sensitivity. It has happened on occasion where when you interview the teacher, this is a religious environment. There is a dress code, and you have to dress respectfully. But what a teacher thinks is dressed respectfully is very different than the way. The Torah would define dressing respectfully, and that certainly poses challenges. And that's not. I remember once when I was in high school, and this was a teacher who did dress very tzanua, and she was a frum woman, a frum teacher, but she was a young woman and she was single. She was teaching whatever subject she was teaching at the time, and I remember a boy raised his hand in class, and the teacher said yes. And he said, maybe after class you and I can go out for some coffee? Like, he asked her out in the middle of class. And she's like, what? Like, that's inappropriate. He's like, okay, no is a no. You don't have to get all upset about it. You know, like, but like that's not so healthy. But obviously if it could be done within reason, it's a communal sensitivity issue. I do think that when men go into chinuch, I think there's a tremendous need for young women, and I've seen this, for young women to have real relationships with positive role models and mentors. And one of the challenges is that many of their teachers are male, and there's this an automatic distance that's going to be there, and that should be there, that ought to be there, where they're not going to be able to connect on the same level. And it's one of the great needs of our community that we have more. And by the way, there's a chinuch crisis. I gave a Musa Shmuz in the Beis Medrash about this a little while ago. There's a chinuch crisis. It's a bigger crisis among the women than it is among the men. Because in Lakewood, where the husbands want to learn, the women can't be teachers anymore because that's not going to pay the bills. So you don't have young, from women that are going into education because it doesn't pay enough. So and now they have the pressure of paying the bills. So it's a crisis there also. So it is an issue that a man who's going into, I have a very close friend who teaches in a girls' high school, and he's excellent at it. He's excellent. The girls admire him, but it's not like an inappropriate. I've seen that also, where like there's an inappropriate admiration. You know that immature 15-year-olds can have such, but they admire him and they respect him and they're close with his wife and they like he's excellent at it. He's really he helps them with their shiduchim and whatever. He's fantastic with it, but it's not an easy balance. If anyone wants to go into women's education, he should probably, we should probably have him come speak to the Smicha students about how to do it properly. Yeah.
Has Derech Chiba changed?
In terms of touching?
Yeah.
So the idea that Negiya b'Derech Taiva, Derech Chiba or Derech Taiva is Asir, is also something that the poskim debate based on their own, sensitivities. For example, Morena Rav Shechter Shlita is of the opinion that a handshake is not called Derech Taiva. So if you go for an interview and the interviewer sticks out her hand, that you're allowed to shake her hand. And that's not called Derech Taiva. If you're on the YU virtual dinner and the interviewer, Oprah's friend, Gail, you guys aren't holding? Okay. So that would not be called Derech Taiva to the stipler writes it's Yahreg Val Yavar. Okay, a little bit of a different take on it. I once told the Rav Shechter always tells the Maisa that Rav Shimon Shkap had a granddaughter who was not so religious, and she was very close to their grandfather, and she once brought home a friend who was also not so religious, or not religious at all, and had very little from background, and she introduced her friend to her grandfather. Zaidi, this is my friend, whatever, right? And the friend sticks out her hand to shake Rav Shimon Shkap's hand. And Rav Shimon Shkap shook her hand. And then after she left, Rav Shimon Shkap said to his granddaughter, it's so sad that she doesn't know enough to know that you're not supposed to stick out a hand to shake a rabbi's hand, but at least I know enough to know not to embarrass somebody. That if she sticks out her hand, that I would shake her hand. So I told that Maisa, because Rav Shechter always tells that Maisa. Then one night I got a phone call, and the person on the other end said, is this Rabbi Leibowitz? I said, yes. He said, this is Kalman Epstein. I said, Rav Kalman? I got very scared. He's Rosh Yeshiva Shaar HaTorah in Queens. Very serious Talmud Chacham, a very serious yeshiva. He said, I heard on a shir, he doesn't listen to my shirim, his daughter listens to my shirim, and she told him, I heard on a shir that you told the story about my Zaidi. He's an Enoch of Shimon Shkap, great-grandson of Shimon Shkap. That he shook a woman's hand, and how could you tell such a maisa? How could you tell such a maisa about Rav Shimon Shkap? Like, where do we know that from? The granddaughter? The granddaughter has no nemanus for anything. How could you tell such a maisa? So thank God, I had some cover. I said, I don't tell that maisa. I only tell the maisa lach that my Rebbe tells, and Rav Shechter tells the maisa, so you could take it up with him. So he said, I will. I said, okay, that's fine, but Rav Shechter tells me. So next time I saw Rav Shechter, I said, did Rav Kalman call you? He said, yeah. I said, he said, how could you tell the Maisa? He's like, I didn't hear it from the granddaughter. I heard from Rav Shimon Shkap's son 60 years ago. He told me that Maisa. And just Rav Kalman was very upset about this Maisa. Because in the world that he lives in now, that's very disturbing. It happens to be just the PS to that story is I was having Shabbos lunch with someone in North Woodmere, in my community, and the person was telling me that he lived in Shaar HaTorah and he used to have the zechus of driving Rav Zelig Epstein from Borough Park where he lived to the yeshiva all the time. He would drive him all the time, Rav Kalman's father, Rav Zelig. So I said, oh, I just had an interaction with Rav Kalman, and I told him what happened, and the guy said, Rav Zelig used to tell that story. I heard the story from Rav Zelig. I said, do me a favor. Next time you see Rav Kalman, please, please tell him that you heard that story from Rav Zelig. And let me know what he says. So he called me back a week later and he said, I saw Rav Kalman. I told him Rav Zelig told the story. He said, I know my father used to tell the story and he used to tell him not to tell that story either. Okay. So fine. But you can understand that, if you're reading a stipler that says it's Yarek Val Yavar, And you're also worried about, you know, what's that going to lead to? What are people going to assume? What else are they going to justify as not being derech taiva? You know, is a peck on the cheek not derech taiva all of a sudden? Just a social hug not derech taiva? Right? There were modern Orthodox synagogues in this country, and there probably still are fewer of them, but some of them, where it's totally acceptable that after davening, you know, everyone goes and gives every, you know, all their friends, including their friends' wives, a peck on the cheek, a little good Shabbos hug. Like, that's crazy. That's a nation's issue you're talking about. That's wild. It used to be rabbis that would do that. Rabbis who lived in yeshivas that are very close to here. Meaning here. That's crazy. That's insanity. Meaning we do need, thank God, you know, Akshar Dara, and we've made strides. We need to make more strides in this area, I think. But it's, you know, we're baderech, right? How does Rav Judah say? We're baderech. So I think, well, we should remain baderech. I think maybe one last question.
Is there anything platonic relationships?
I don't know. Is that recording still going around? Is Rabbi Orlovsky, you know, in his platonic? No, you guys are a different generation. Okay. It's irrelevant whether they exist or not. It's not something to strive for. Meaning, you should always be respectful, and you love every single Jew, and you'll go to the ends of the world to do chesed for every Jew, man and woman alike, and you are kind and nice and good. But to have a warm, overly comfortable relationship is simply not healthy. You know, friends of mine made fun of me a little bit, some very close friends of mine, because I used them as an example in a shir that I gave, and they're like, oh, now we have to be careful how we talk around, because they were talking about when they go to the gym. Now, in the five towns, there are some gyms that are women-only, and there are some gyms that have men's-only hours. In the community where they live, apparently there's no such thing. The guy said, he mentioned at a Shabbos table, it's so awkward when you're at the gym and the person they pair you up with is someone else's wife. Well, awkward? You mean like usher? Like that's crazy. Like, why would that ever happen? That's terrible. So I didn't say that at the Shabbos table, I said it in a shir. So then, like, next time I went to their house, they're like, oh, we better be careful what we say, you know. But that's not appropriate. That's, you know, that's in gym clothing when you're when everyone's working on their bodies. I mean, that's insanity. But, you know, again, we have what to work on. We have a lot of things to work on, and this is the topic you asked me to speak about. I could speak just as passionately about many other topics that I think we have to work on, and many other topics that we're doing great and we should still be better at. We should still continue to work on. Everyone should have a wonderful evening.